Welcome to Important Not Important. My name is Quinn Emmett.
And I'm Brian Colbert Kennedy.
Somehow. And this is episode 8. Today we're going to make a game plan for guaranteeing a comprehensive science education for every student in America so they can become full and able-bodied citizens and save the planet that we have so thoroughly destroyed.
Joining us today to talk about that is Don Dugan Haas, a lifetime educator, author, and activist for science education, as well as Therese Itoka and Jay Bonsall, two high school students and immigrants and generally incredible young people from Idaho who actively fought to keep the climate change education in the Boise curriculum when a bunch of people wanted it taken out again.
And thank God for Don. I mean, he literally, and people say this shit all the time, wrote the textbook on science education
in
America.
People say it all the time, but he literally did it.
Right. And I mean, if Therese and Jay aren't running this place one day, I'm out. You know? Do you hear their enthusiasm?
They were incredible.
You're so excited.
I really do look up to them.
Yeah. And they're immigrants. It's awesome.
Speaking
of immigration, Brian prefers... Australian coffee.
I don't prefer Australian coffee. I had merely mentioned that I like the Australian cafes that are popping up everywhere.
You were vehement about it. A place opened downstairs, and I said, it's Australian. You said, well, that's the best coffee. And I said,
I don't know that. I didn't say it was the best coffee. I said it was good, and I like, they're very passionate about their espresso drinks. What's wrong with enjoying that?
Who isn't passionate? That's like saying that Americans aren't passionate.
Go to Starbucks. They don't give a fuck.
I don't drink enough coffee to know, to be honest. It just felt like you're being exclusive.
Maybe this is why I should be the one who talks about it and you should take a back seat. You have a lot of things over me, but let me have coffee over
like
you, sir.
Like what?
What do you mean? You were a lot of stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. This is going nowhere.
Nowhere.
All right. Just like that, we're ready to go. Let's go talk to these guys.
Let's do it.
Our guests today are Therese Itoka, Jay Bonsall, and Don Dugan Haas. Therese was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo and is a 17-year-old senior at Boise High in Idaho. She testified before the Boise City Council in December to support more energy-efficient codes and wrote about it in the local paper. She's part of a group of teens who apparently call themselves the Climate Justice League, which we're definitely going to get to.
Yes.
Jay is a basketball player and student at Capitol High in Idaho. He's a YouTuber, a podcaster, an ultimate, and an intern at HP. Brian?
Yeah, real quick, Jay, you have to excuse us. We're over 30. What is an ultimate?
Oh, so it's Ultimate Frisbee. I play Ultimate Frisbee.
I knew it. All right. Brian said we were out of touch, and I said, no, it's Ultimate Frisbee.
Yeah. So I actually just tried out for the national team a month ago. And then high school season's about to start here next week.
Well, wait, how did tryouts go?
Tryouts went well. I actually got a concussion during tryouts, so I've been dealing with that for the past 2.5 weeks. But I'll get to know if I make the team here someday.
All right. Well, Brian's definitely going to come watch one of your games. Matches?
Yeah.
Yep. Definitely. He loves that stuff. Well, best of luck.
Thank you.
And then we've got Don. Don is, and I'll quote his Twitter profile here. I help Earth systems science educators kick butt as director of teacher programs at the Paleontological Research Institution's Museum of the Earth and president of the National Association of Geoscience Teachers. Don, did I get that straight?
You did.
Awesome. These guys all worked their asses off to get climate science included in Idaho's education standards, a huge win for the next generation of Americans.
Yes.
Together, we're going to take the lessons they've learned and figure out how to guarantee every American student, the next generation and the ones after that, your children, get the full science education we need them to get. So let's find out who they are. Therese, Jay, and Don, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here, guys.
All right. So set the tone. We're big believers in questions here, but questions that don't provoke action are basically just philosophy. Philosophy is great, but these times call for action, as you guys know better than anybody. And that's where we're going to try to go to here and what we're trying to provoke. So what we want to do is get some quick context from you, who you are and what you do. We established a little bit of that. Jay is a better athlete than us. And then we'll progress to the topic of the day and some actionable steps our listeners can take, something that will inspire them to get to work at whatever level, whatever party they subscribe to. Deal?
Awesome.
Deal.
All right. So, Therese, Jay, Don, we start with one question. Therese, you're going to be up first.
All right, sounds good.
I want you to be bold and honest because you're here for a reason. Therese, why are you vital to the survival of the species?
Wow. I mean, that's a long answered question, but I believe I'm vital to the species because I really provide, who I am as a person into what I do. And I have a passion for pushing for equal rights, whether it be women's rights, humans' rights, climate justice. And I feel that with my personal background and just for the love that what I do, that's where I see myself as vital.
I love it. Awesome.
Amazing.
All right.
Can I quickly add one other question?
Yeah.
If you were in the normal Justice League, who would you be?
Great question.
If I was in the normal Justice League, like who would I be? Or yeah,
which superhero yeah, which would superhero? You be? Yeah.
Pretty well, vital. The one superhero that I would love to be is actually Black Panther.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's so good.
But Brian he's not in the Justice League.
I know. He's not in the Justice League, but I would really like to be
still
Black
a good
Panther.
Answer. Still a good answer.
Jay, leave it alone. Okay. Now's not the time.
Stick to Ultimate Frisbee,
yeah,
Jay.
Yeah. I just saw it Monday and I was just blown away by, having representation and just what it means to me and the whole community. I would really love to be Black Panther.
Hell yes.
Yes. I love it. Shuri is just my hero. Yeah. She's, yeah. Oh God.
We were just listening to the soundtrack.
It's a great movie.
Just seeing women and technology and STEM and just having that role. Yeah, that really empowered me.
Awesome. We will definitely get more to that. All right, Jay, you got a lot to live up to. Why are you vital to the survival of the species?
This is almost like a braggy question, about myself, right? You know, don't be
it's
modest.
Sort of it is, but what? If I can say one thing about it, and we instituted this question a couple episodes ago because it is it's a lot for us to have said this from the beginning with our newsletter and podcast. Like, this is what we feel is most vital. That's a little presumptuous, but we do feel like it is because there's so much stuff that's buried out there under whatever news you see. And this is even before Trump. And you're on this show now for a reason, which is you're among a group of handpicked guests we believe are truly changing the world. And folks like you guys, unfortunately, aren't the superstars that we hear about every day.
Yeah.
The celebrities we hear about.
Yeah.
And, more importantly, you're on this planet. I'm not going to say you're on this planet for a reason because that would imply some sort of predestiny. And we certainly don't have time for that today. It's a wonderful discussion to have. But you guys are, all three of you are here. And everyone at some point either makes or should make a decision why they feel like they're here, what they're supposed to do with their time here. And maybe that changes over time. And that's great. But I feel like you two, you young folks and Don have clearly made some decisions and I don't want to say necessarily stand up for yourself, but make your stand. Tell us why you're vital.
Awesome. So, I would say I'm vital. I think my passion and dedication and just perseverance to wanting the best for everyone in this world is vital to the species. I think I'm very passionate about all the things I do. Might not be a lot of things, but the few things I do, I'd like to say I am really good at them. And then I'm also very dedicated. And I'd say my leadership skills at a young age or so is needed for not just the youth, but also as growing up. Hopefully it'll turn into something that's on a bigger scale and I can make a bigger difference than just my local community. And I think that's why I'd say I'm vital to the survival of our species.
I love that.
Fantastic.
And I look forward to checking in with you guys. So you better hold up to that.
Yeah.
All right, Don, you've been here a little bit longer doing this for longer than the rest of us. And we can't thank you enough for leading the way. So tell us, why are you vital to the survival of the species?
Well, I've been working for over 30 years in education and trying to change the system, trying to actually in certain ways overthrow the system because it doesn't really have a setup that's very much in tune with how people actually learn. Mm-hmm. So working real hard on that, been working all of those 30 plus years on trying to help people better understand the Earth system because it's hugely important to understand how the system works. And I think we have been doing fairly poorly at that, but I have ideas about how to change it.
I love it. I love it. And you're trying to change it. And that's more than most folks. But, if we can leave with one thing today, it's hopefully to inspire folks to be more like you guys.
And be as optimistic as you guys.
Yes. Which is also a difficult thing today.
Yeah.
All right. So we are going to dive into the, some context and then dive into our topic and question of the day. Brian, take us there.
So guys, and I guess we'll go in the same order. Should we keep it nice and simple?
Let's just get going.
Let's just get going. Tell us in a few sentences how education standards and curriculum are planned and regulated. Maybe that'd be good for Don.
What was that last part?
Regulated, I think.
Planned and regulated?
Basically, yeah. You know, we're going to talk about what happened in Idaho over the past couple of years and everywhere across America, but we just always want to give our listeners a little bit of a context of how do these education standards come to be? Talk to us like we're 4-year-olds. Is it federal government, state government, local school boards, et cetera, et cetera? Just a quick primer on how these things come about.
I mean, working with the science standards, it's been a 3-year process, and I've been in here for about 2.5 years. And it's just seeing that our legislators kind of felt that they have the ability to take away information that should be given to students just based on the political affiliation or party affiliation, which I don't think is right at all. I mean, the students' education is necessary, and it provides us with a place to learn, and information shouldn't be restricted. And so with the science standards, we wanted to include supporting content, which is there to teach and aid elementary school teachers when there are teachers who are teaching literally one classroom. They teach everything. And so those supporting content and those standards encourage them and help them and guide them to know specifically what to teach. And also the importance of them is to also allow inquiry and conclusion coming from students. And so allowing students to form their own conclusions and learning to be the scientists as well.
Yeah. And I think like the regulations and like standards are in place because Idaho wants their students at elementary or like middle school or high school level to learn a certain amount of things before they graduate from their schools. So they have these contents in place. And the whole debate was that Idaho wanted to take some of the things out. So like specific references to man effect on climate change would be taken out from like these standards, and teachers would then not be like required to teach that. And if they did teach that, they could get a lot of backlash from parents, from the students, or the government even.
Gotcha. Okay, but even just taking a step back, and maybe Don, you can help inform this a little bit since you're a lifetimer. How are education standards scripted? Who does it and who has to follow it, et cetera, et cetera? Educate us on education.
That's a big, big question. And it's literally a cast of thousands. I'm part of that cast for the Next Generation Science Standards, which are the new-ish national standards for science education. They're based upon a document called, I hope I get this right, I don't have it in front of me, a framework for K-12 science education, and then there's a colon and something after the colon that I don't quite remember, I'm an author sort of on that document. I was part of the Earth and Space Science Design team that helped develop what are called the disciplinary core ideas for the Earth and space sciences. And these are importantly national standards, but not federal standards.
So wait, stop right there. So what's the difference between national and federal standards?
Well, they were not developed with federal support in a direct way anyway, and they are not federally mandated. Education is a state and local decision for the most part. And many states have adopted these standards that were developed with support from an organization called ACHIEVE, which is kind of a spawn of the National Governors Association. And I think it came about in the 1990s, if I remember right.
So they're not binding, is what you're saying.
They are not federally binding, and so there are no federal standards. The Common Core are not federal standards, which deal with language arts and mathematics. The Next Generation Science Standards are not federal standards, but those are both sets of national standards, and they were developed with support from the National Research Council and this organization called ACHIEVE, a nonprofit, and then states decide whether to adopt them or adapt them or none of the above. I think a little bit more than half the population of students in the country are in states that have adopted them. And I should have looked states that is, but I think it's somewhere between 16 and 20 states have either adopted them outright or adapted them, which was, you know, an adaptation that some states have looked into is striking content about climate change and evolution.
Gotcha.
And Idaho looked into that and then didn't do that. There is much more attention to climate change in these standards that are being adopted across the country now than there were in the previous set of national standards, which again were national and not federal. And those were the 1996.
Okay.
96. Boys, it's only been over 20 years.
Yeah, a little bit's changed
since then.
Maybe they
should be updated.
Yeah.
So I guess that clarifies a couple things for me. I'm trying to just wrap my head around and for our listeners too, which is thinking back to Race to the Top and to No Child Left Behind. I guess because they're national and not federal, this is why the government, the national government, the federal government, would design incentives for people to meet, for schools and teachers to meet these incentives with, or to meet these standards with Common Core and things like that, because they couldn't mandate them. Am I wrong there?
Yeah, that's about right. Okay. And it's also worth noting that different states have adopted these at different times over the last few years and more will in the coming years. New York just officially adapted them about a year ago and are in the process of a long rollout, in part because they did a fast rollout of Common Core and screwed it up.
Got it.
And they don't want to repeat that mistake. So there are a lot of problems with the Common Core rollout in a lot of places. And so some places are going slower with the science standards.
Okay, got it. So I think that clarifies a little bit. And then just summarizing here from Think Progress to catch us up completely, they said basically this year when lawmakers voted for a second time to remove key references to climate science from education standards in Idaho, one representative defended the move by arguing that the decision didn't prohibit teachers from teaching the science, only that it was no longer required for teachers to do so. But critics of removing the references, so you guys, argued that the lack of statewide standards would leave teachers, especially those in more rural districts where climate science is considered more politically controversial, without meaningful resources to help teach kids about climate change. Because as we all know, teachers can afford to teach whatever they want. They can afford to bring in any materials they need, can't they? Okay. So it was discussed, but you guys saved the day in Idaho. Job well done. But like you said, 16 to 20 states have either adopted or adapted this. So it sounds like, I think there's about 30 states left. So the fight isn't anywhere near over, is it, guys?
Yeah. And I'll try and look that up while we're talking to and confirm that I've got the right number.
Got it. Therese, and Jay, do I have my head wrapped around this? I feel like we've tried to explain it a little bit.
Yeah. As you said, like the critics, we say like in rural districts where it's like very political to like think, say, climate change is real and people might not agree. If teachers aren't required to teach that, they can get a lot of backlash and even fired from their job.
Yeah. We attended a couple of public forums and some of the teachers came down and they're kind of nervous and scared to teach it because those communities are a lot closer. Everyone knows each other. And so if they receive pushback from a parent, it's like a whole community knows what's going on. So definitely difficult in that area.
Yeah. And another piece of this puzzle is that if the state doesn't include climate change or evolution or whatever other content in the standards, then that probably means that that certainly means that if there's a statewide test, which most states do have a statewide science test, if there's a state test, it will not include climate change unless climate change is in the standard. So what gets tested generally is what gets taught. Some teachers will go above and beyond what's actually on the test, but as a sort of rule of thumb, what gets tested is what gets taught. And following up on the earlier thing, over 40 states have shown interest in the standards. As of November of 2017, 19 states, along with the District of Columbia, have adopted the standards.
So, and not to terrify our listeners, that doesn't mean that 30 states aren't teaching climate change.
Okay. No.
Right.
That's correct.
I mean, look, the world is burning. There's a little bit of nightmare out there, but it's not that bad. It's just that they haven't officially, like you said, adopted or adapted these standards, correct?
Right. That's right.
Well, that's good. All right. So let's get to our topic this week, guys, which is how can we guarantee the next generation of American students gets a full science education with, like actual facts, real facts.
Right.
And becomes a generation of problem solvers. Right now, there's a lot of info out there about where U.S. students lie among math and science.
Not great, Bob.
Not great. We're sort of lagging, and obviously a huge change needs to be made. So, yeah, what do we do?
Part of me says throw out the system, but like that's not an easy lift.
That's a pretty punk rock answer there, Don.
Yeah, well, you know, a fundamental challenge that we face is that the structure of schools isn't really informed by what we know, what research says about how people learn. And in fact, not only is the structure of schools uninformed by research on how people learn, it's pretty much structured to work against it. If you didn't know anything about schools, but you know about how you learn stuff, and somebody came up to you and said, hey, I've got a great idea. Let's put 2,000 teenagers into a building and split them up into groups.
Stop right there.
15 or 25 or 30 or something, and have somebody talk at a group about the Battle of Hastings for 45 minutes, and then they move right down the hall and have somebody else talk to them about climate change or rocks or algebra or whatever. And let's do that day after day after day, year after year after year for years on end. Isn't that a great idea? It's like, no.
Right. Right. So Therese and Jay, I mean, was there a point before 10 seconds ago? And I think it's probably true because you're here, that you guys realized that this is not the most efficient and practical way to, and again, I know it's two levels and maybe it's a second conversation about the problem solving thing. I could go on a whole tangent about that, but have you guys already realized like, wait, this isn't, are you guys in, is it a public school you're in?
Yes. Yeah, both public schools.
Great,
both
of us. Yeah.
Public school for life.
Two different high schools, right? Yeah.
So do you guys agree with that? Do you feel like, oh my God, someone's just sitting here reading me facts off a slide from 20 years ago, and this isn't the most efficient way to go? How does it feel in the moment right now?
I mean, I kind of see that, but to an extent. I mean, I'm at Boise High School, and a lot of my teachers and a lot of the teachers that I've had in the past allow for us to be, I mean, the leaders, and also allow for us to do individual projects where we come up and we teach the class. Like tomorrow I have a hot topic, which is where we do like we have a different country, we're assigned a different country, and then we pick an article, we print it out and give it to the students, they read it, and then we provide them with questions, and we teach them, I mean, what we believe is most important, or what we believe is really, I mean, what they should know. So
is that due tomorrow?
Oh, it's already done. It's already done.
Just, of course it is.
Just a second. I was going to say, maybe you should go.
But yeah, I have some teachers where, I mean, it's just reading off the PowerPoint, and I really don't enjoy those classes because it feels like busy work and it feels like I'm just sitting there and it's long. But I have the teachers who really love their job and really love to see their students getting hands-on and really delving into the topics that they love too.
I mean, I think the only reason I'm into this, a lot of the environmental work I do and like speaking and stuff, is because of my AP environmental science teacher. Mm-hmm. My AP environmental science teacher took his initiative. He also himself—
what's his name? Let's call him out.
Mr. Butler, Aaron Butler.
Butler! Shout out to
Mr. Butler. Hell yeah, Mr. Butler.
Yeah. He motivated me to just, like, he one day, before I took AP environmental science, I had heard the word climate change and global warming thrown around, and I knew kind of about the science, but I didn't knew like all the cause and effects and all the different things that are impacting and stuff. And Mr. Butler didn't come at it at the way of like, oh, I'm going to make you believe climate change is real. I don't care who you are. But rather than he's like, he presented me with the facts, the science, and he's like, okay, you guys draw your own conclusions now. Like, I just showed you what the science is and everything. And if you can refute that, then well, that's your problem, but I don't think there's anything you can say. And so after that, I'm like, this is a huge problem. Like, how was I so blind to this? And so I think a lot of the burden comes down to parents and also educators, like teachers. They need to be passionate about what they do and not just think of it as like a way of living and then they go home and watch football every Sunday night just because they need something like that.
Yeah, screw football.
Yeah, and I should clarify, I didn't mean to imply that schooling doesn't work at all.
No, I mean, in a lot of cases, it's the very best they can do. It's just like, yeah. I mean, there is definitely an argument that the system was designed for World War II and it's broken.
Right. Yeah. And the fact that, teachers are able to be successful in a framework that's not really designed for success is a huge testament to the skill and passion of those teachers.
Sure.
So, yeah, I'm very clear. I love teachers. I have been one. Various roles for 30 plus years and many of them amongst my best friends.
Yep. I mean, my mom was a kindergarten teacher. I worship them and nobody's, you know, you can't say in general that everybody's perfect, but these people are quite literally training our next generation for basically no money. And the least we can do is provide them with, do our best to provide them with a system that is adaptable and dynamic and structured to, like you said, hey, 30 years ago, we didn't really understand how people learn. And now we do. And it's time to start applying that, whether it's creative writing or AP environmental science, which PS did not exist when I was in school. I took a lot of AP, took a lot of AP classes. Some of them went well, some of them not so much. but I can tell you, I would have been pretty drawn to AP environmental science. And maybe this whole thing is just me trying to make up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd also different like discussion. To... shout out, I mean, my teacher, Mrs. Church, I mean, she allows us we're actually using her classroom right now. She gave me permission to use it.
Nice. And,
she allows us to, we had a Skype conversation recently with someone who works at the Department of State and was also an ambassador and a diplomat and allows for us to, I mean, I can see myself going in that career or even a future in that. And she allows us to have like direct connections and attend a pundits forum, like meetings and city club luncheons. And so she really allows for us to really interact and education.
That's awesome. And there's got to be so many other inspiring stories out there like that are helping to build little model citizens like you guys are, putting the rest of us to shame. So on the other side, the second question is, maybe this is just the answer, but aside from the Heartland Institute, what's actually driving the lawmakers in these states to pull these extreme measures to try to cut climate science out? Is it the money lining their pockets? Is it their own belief systems? Is it religion? You know, mom and dad work for oil and gas. What do you guys feel like in your experience so far, all three of you? What are the typical type of players? What are the typical obstacles and forces you're running up against as you fight this battle?
Well, the short answer to all those, you know, is it this or is it that of all those things you listed off is yes, it's all of those
great.
Things.
Next question.
And you know, what the genesis for you asking me to be on the show is that I'm a co-author of a book called The Teacher Friendly Guide to Climate Change,
right.
Which you can find by Google. And in there is, yes, very good. In there is a set of rules of thumb for talking about controversial issues, and climate change is the, you know, obvious specific example in the teacher-friendly guide to climate change. One of those rules is be nice, and a sub-point of that be nice is that most people are telling what they believe to be the truth. Mm-hmm. So most of the people who are wrong about climate change, who don't think that it's a big deal and don't think that it's human caused or don't think that it's happening at all, most of those folks actually believe that.
That's amazing.
And that comes from lying about it. They just
that's a lot of different places. And it's go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's a strong sign of empathy there, Don.
Yeah,
I think we could all use a little bit of. So
right.
I'm going to take that and go with it.
Yeah, I think it's really, really important to recognize that all of us believe something that's obviously bullshit and
sure.
probably quite a few things that are obviously bullshit. And there's clear evidence that we're wrong about some things. And, you know, if you're married, just ask your spouse if that's true and you'll get a confirmation there.
If you ever get my wife on this podcast, she'll ruin it.
I've been thinking about these issues for years and years and years. And what's the most important thing for people to understand about the Earth system has been a big focus of my research for a long time. And for years, I believed that the most important thing was to understand about the nature of systems and the Earth as a complex system, which I still think is hugely, hugely important. Sure. But now I've because of work on not only climate change, but also hydraulic fracturing or fracking for short. Mm-hmm. We also wrote a book about that and included a chapter on teaching about that. I've come to believe that more important than understanding systems is understanding why almost everyone believes things that are obviously just not true, and that there's ample evidence to show that they're not true. And that has to do with cognitive biases and logical fallacies. And mm-hmm. there's information in the book on digging into those, but people have a hard, one of the big ones is the status quo bias, which, in short, means that we like to do what we've always done or are driven to do what we've always done, and change is hard. There's much more to it than that. Another big piece is the sunk cost fallacy, because
sure.
the belief that because we've spent lots of time and resources and money on something, that if we stop doing that, we've wasted all that, all of those resources. The reality is those resources are gone no matter what, whether you continue working in that system or switch to a different system. Mm-hmm. So that's those two are two of the biggest obstacles that a lot of people don't know very much about.
And Therese and Jay, do you guys feel like empathy is one of your main tools in dealing either with these frustrating lawmakers or for even folks your own age?
Actually, yeah. I had a recent conversation with one of my classes on, empathy and the lack of it in our society today. Because it seems that we've become so, so close-minded and towards ourselves. And with social media, we can close off something when we don't want to see it. And so it's mm-hmm. leading to a lack of empathy, and it's really changing how we interact with each other. And it's really changing how we really, how we care about each other, mm-hmm. if then. And so with, with the legislators, sometimes it's kind of trying to see what standpoint they're coming from. I don't necessarily agree with that. I usually don't, but it's kind of like trying to see where are they coming from. And sometimes I can't figure out where they're coming from. So it's hard mm-hmm. to empathize then.
I think sure. we all live in our own bubble, right? Like on Twitter and Instagram, we follow our friends and people we agree with. We're not mm-hmm. going to follow someone we radically hate and always love sure. seeing things we get really used to agreeing with everything or opinion, and we try to formulate like, okay, I strongly believe in this, and I don't know if there's going to be another opinion that was going to change me. So a lot of times as humans, it's hard to empathize with a very, very polarizing opposite opinion that's opposite to yours. But I think also when we were like testifying against the legislators and against the standards, one big tool when we were writing our testimonies was empathy. We're not trying to make the legislators wrong, even though we think they're wrong. we're not going to try to make them wrong.
Nobody responds well when you just tell them that they're wrong.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. No, yeah. So we were trying to empathize with them. And I think that was a big reason, like especially in the Senate when it did pass, like our empathizing testimonies that, okay, we see that you guys might not agree with our own values, but we as students want to tell you that we really care about this, and you guys should at least look at like how we come at it. And you as legislators, you guys have the burden of like helping us get the best education possible.
Yeah, and Jay makes a really good point. Talking about the legislators empathizing with our testimony, and understanding our situation where we come from, then also as students, where we see ourselves with education and how we value it. It's empathizing with us as students. We care about our education.
Sure.
It's a two-way road.
It is.
Sort of emphasizing a point that I think Quinn made is that if you call someone a stupid yeah. jerk,
yeah.
who are very, very unlikely to change their mind about whatever it is sure. you think they're a stupid jerk mm-hmm. related to. And yet we do that all the time. And I mean, sort worse. Of the royal we there. Yeah. And it's just getting worse.
Yeah.
Facebook and Twitter and so forth are sort of amplifying that. But at the same time, there's a real advantage to social media as an education platform that we don't have in K-12 or undergraduate education. And that's that your relationships on social media probably last a long time. And so you mm-hmm. can have a conversation that takes years And for most people, it's going to take years for them to change their mind. Mm-hmm. And another one of those rules of thumb is to be persistent. And social media, actually, if you can be civil on social media, mm-hmm. and you can carry on the conversation over years, you can actually change people's minds.
Sure. Okay.
So you guys didn't call people stupid jerks. Great. You empathized with as many people as you could, and you won in Idaho. You guys did it, which is pretty incredible. And now, you know, I guess what else did you do? Like, we need to obviously do this in every other state we can now. What specifically did you guys do to overcome those forces in Idaho?
So, I mean, there was a couple different things. So, I think one big part was a couple of Democratic representatives in this House, at least, and some of the Senate members who were a very, very big push in terms of that they thought this was the big issue and they advocated for a lot. Like last year in March 2017, Representative Rubel here of Idaho for District 18, she set up an Idaho Climate Change Forum that just... Mm-hmm. Invited literally everyone and every single legislator to come get educated and at least maybe draw your own conclusions, like sure. a class maybe. But it was a whole forum, and I was the closing speaker, and almost 600 people showed up.
Yeah, 650 actually.
But only 3 to 4 legislators came from the whole House.
Sure.
But that was at least a start. It was a start in the right direction. Like it made Boise Weekly, it made Idaho Statesman, it made a lot of big news, and we know almost every single legislator saw that. And they're like, okay, 650 people coming, the biggest ever Idaho forum in the past 10 years. The public at least cares about it a little bit.
Sure.
So that was like kind of like a
big push, like the takeoff kind of step. And I mean, after that, there were public forums held to, show what the science standards were being changed and how they were being, they were going to be changed and how they're going to be different. And that allowed for public commentary. And there was, I think, 1,000 comments that were in favor of it. Only, I think there was maybe 1,000 comments given, and there was only like 5 that were negative. And so it allowed for the public to see what was going on and then to also have their input as well. And from that, I mean, a lot of other actions started occurring. And then our part came in pretty recently.
Yeah, with the testimonies. I think Chris Taylor was a big reason for us like having that opportunity to give testimonies. He is like the guy who kind of makes all these standards.
So tell us who Chris is.
He's the head of the Department of Social Studies, Science, and Computer Science in the Boise School District. And he worked to, revise these standards. And he's been working on this for the past 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so because of Chris, I think he also was, again, a big push on the internal side. Like, okay, they passed these standards three years ago. They took them out, the supporting contents. We want them back. So he kept revising, kept pushing, talking to legislators. And so finally, you know, there was a vote for the revise again just in December. And that's when, like, our testimonies came through.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So paint the picture real quick for me. Were you guys like, hey, we heard this is going on, let us get in there? Or did he say, you know what, let's call in the troops, let's get the actual kids involved?
So I think Chris, he was a big teacher at Timberline, or like he had a lot of student contacts at Timberline. Yeah, so
it was a little bit of both.
Yeah. Kind
of.
And so he definitely wanted students to testify. So he already had like Emily, her, and Cassie. I forgot Cassie's last name.
Kenyon.
Yeah, Kenyon. Cassie Kenyon. So they both are part of the Climate Justice League that we're part of. Mm-hmm. And so he already wanted them. He wanted them to testify. And so they... since Emily and Cassie were both part of the Justice League, it kind of got the other schools involved, like Boise High and Capitol and Bora. And that's when we kind of, all as students, kind of got behind it.
Gotcha.
And since we're back on Justice League, Jay, who would you be?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. I would 100% be Batman.
Yeah, good
because
call,
I have had the biggest obsession with Batman since ever. And I consistently say I'm Batman, even though I'm nothing like, I don't look like Batman or have any affiliation to Batman.
But if you just keep saying it, maybe you'll be Batman.
I think Jay should do the Batman voice.
No, I don't.
I think you should.
Jay, you have to do the rest of the conversation in your Christian Bale voice. No. Okay, so... we've got, again, 20 to 30 more states that aren't opposing this, to be clear, opposing these standards that Don's worked, you know, his whole life on.
No big deal.
But at the same time, we're going to run into issues again, no doubt. But how do you guys feel like do you feel like you found a blueprint in what you did? Do you feel like there were lessons learned that can apply other places? Obviously, each state, each legislature, each school district is...
Clone Chris Taylor.
Is different. Yep. Chris Taylor, check.
Step number one.
You know, you guys, is there... I don't know. Are there people to call on? Is there a blueprint made now that can affect other places?
I would say there's not like an exact blueprint, but I mean, for me, it definitely started with wanting this change to happen. And there was like an environmental club at my school, and then it kind of disappeared. And I mean, I didn't know why. And so I still kept doing the environmental work and still finding ways to be involved. And so that's what led to all of this. But I mean, it's been a really long process. It took, we did a petition on an Add Up campaign, and we got over 1,000 signatures from students, from teachers, from educators.
We got 1,000 signatures in a week.
Three days, actually. It was like 64 hours, I think, exactly, where we hit that 1,000 mark. But I mean, it took a lot. I mean, I had to talk to a lot of students and talk to a lot of teachers. And
what
do
was
the
petition
work.
For specifically?
The petition was going to be presented. So we were going to testify, I think, on a Thursday.
Yeah.
And we wanted 1,000 signatures saying that Idaho students want the revised standards.
Uh-huh.
And, that's great.
We put it out like Sunday night at 10 p.m. And then I think on Wednesday at like 2 something. Yeah, that's when we hit 1,000. And so... I mean, it was incredible to see that support. I mean, I personally like spoke to teachers that had really influenced my love for education in elementary school and junior high. And I mean, showed them what I was doing and showed that,
that's awesome.
I mean, their impact on my education is really, I mean, why I was really advocating for this as well.
I'm sure that didn't make them cry at all. how many, do you guys have any idea how many students are in your school district or at least high school students or anything like that?
Oh, in the Boise school district?
Yeah.
I'd say, well, at least, I think at Capital, we have 1,200 students.
And here at Boise, we have like 1,500. Yeah.
And then let's say like 1,400 by four schools. And so that would be about 5,500 students.
And you got 1,000 signatures? That's a hell of a chunk.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah.
Jesus, that's incredible. That's awesome. And okay, well, that is something that can be applied, you know, that can go other places, which is get the students involved in some, maybe it's testimony. If it comes to that, necessary. I mean, personal stories always help, but that, getting those kind of numbers on board to say, hey, you're talking about us, you know, and our little brothers and sisters, we get a vote, and this is our vote, which is we want this, you know, we're not going to be the silent majority here. It feels like that's something that can be used going forward. Don, any thoughts on that? I mean, this isn't your first battle. It's not going to be your last one.
I have lots of thoughts on that. One is that I think we're seeing student voices being heard just in the last few weeks in a way that we haven't heard since, I think, the 60s.
It's incredible.
And
inspiring.
I think that's awesome. I think that's a fundamental part of strategy for success. So gun violence, obviously, is what's brought it to the fore most directly, but on climate change, there are students that are suing the federal government over climate change.
Oh, yeah, I think we've covered that.
That kind of activism is hugely important and powerful, and a great piece of what's going on. And you know, a thing that we are doing with my colleagues at the Paleontological Research Institution is when we were working on our book, The Teacher-Friendly Guide to Climate Change, and we're very, very close to done when the Heartland Institute started mailing out their book, which I believe the title is Why Scientists Disagree About Climate Change, which they don't, by heart. Their goal was to send it to every science teacher in the country.
Yeah, we saw a number like 200,000, something
yes,
like that.
Yes, yes. And they've sent it to tens of thousands. I don't know if they've reached 200,000, but they've sent it to tens of thousands. And like I said, this hit the news just as we were putting the finishing touches on layout, and we had finished the layout of almost every chapter, and we said, well, we can't really go back because we're behind schedule already, but we can add an FAQ chapter where we addressed the Heartland Institute claims, and we said, this is a teachable moment and an opportunity for us to respond, so we decided to do a crowdfunding campaign to get our book to every science teacher in the country, and it's actually relevant to more than just science teachers.
Yeah.
And we've had a remarkable success, I think, so far. It's a year-long campaign, and we've raised, at this point, raised enough money to send it to 8 states. We have not shipped to all 8 yet, but we shipped to Idaho a week before last. And one of the reasons that we shipped to Idaho is because we had a restricted gift, and that relates to these kinds of political issues going on in Idaho. So another reason is that Idaho has 165 public high schools. New York has over 1,200. So Idaho was a little easier to check off the list.
Sure. Yeah.
just a little bit.
Before I forget, where are you doing the fundraising for this? Is it Kickstarter or somewhere else?
GiveGab, but again, if you search for Teacher Friendly Guide to Climate Change and you throw in crowdfunding, you'll find it, and we can put the link in the show notes too.
Great. Yeah.
And I'll just rattle off the states that we have funding for: New York, Idaho, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa, and Nevada. And
awesome.
As I said, we've shipped to Idaho. We're, I think, more than halfway done shipping to New York. And then we'll dig into what's next after that. We haven't actually figured out which states are going to be next in line, but we do have them. We will be sending them to Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa, and Nevada. And all of those 6 states that I just rattled off were also done with targeted gifts from people who have more money than I do.
Right.
But it's actually surprisingly inexpensive. So it would cost on the order of $8,000 to send it to every school in Massachusetts, for example.
What was that number?
$8,000.
For each school?
Yeah, to get it to every school. And what's in a package is a hard copy of the book and CDs of the book for every science teacher in the building and some other supporting materials. And actually, the Teacher-Friendly Guide to Climate Change is the 10th in the series of Teacher-Friendly Guides, and the other guides are on the CD as well.
Oh, cool.
Important question. Therese, Jay, do you want me to explain what a CD is?
Compact disc, actually.
Wow. Did you just Google that? How did you know?
Yeah, don't cheat. All right.
Do you have this podcast on CD?
Yeah, right. So we've got student involvement, which, like you said, has really come back around. And you know, just the tiniest side thing, there was this picture online of yesterday, the day before, of those students going back to school in Parkland. And there was a line of like 9 golden retriever empathy dogs waiting for them. But a buddy of mine noticed, I'm sure someone else posted this before, but up above on the front of the school was that great Gandhi quote, be the change you wish to see in the world. And it just made me think of everything they've done in the past few weeks and everything your guys' generation is going to do. And it just made me feel like, and excuse my French, like, boy, they really fucked with the wrong school. Like that motto is written on the front of the school, and it's the first thing besides golden retrievers they see when they come back. And boy, have they embraced that over the past through horrific circumstances. But you have to imagine, I'm sure they're teenagers. You know, you walk past that every day and probably don't think about it for a while until you do. And then you go, oh no, I got it. I got it. And now I have the tools, you know, blows 1968 out of the water. To do that sort of thing. So anyways, I just thought that was a wonderfully small moment, but important one, which shows like this isn't going to stop.
Another piece of the strategy that we haven't said much about is that I'm president of the National Association of Geoscience Teachers, and we mobilize our membership to go and testify when stuff like this comes up in their states. And we've got, I think we're at about 1,800 members now, all over the country. So we can get people to those hearings, and those people are usually either university, college and university faculty or high school teachers who are all teaching geoscience in one way or another.
Sure. All right. So we're moving our way through sort of this blueprint, which is student involvement, whether it's online or it's testifying or it's petitions like that. And not every petition is going to work, but when you get a big chunk, that does make a difference to say we're here. We're listening. We want to be involved. We should be the ones involved here. And then you've got materials like Don's book, materials that most teachers can't afford on their own if teachers aren't, schools aren't providing them for them.
I will note that the PDF is free online, and we'll put that link in the show notes.
Yes, absolutely. And then further, getting some of those teachers to testify themselves. One of my question is, has there, and forgive my ignorance here if I didn't find this in your guys' travails over the past year, but has there been any attempt to appeal to parents? You know, the world is changing so fast. Your children will be left behind. They're being left behind already. Your children won't be part of the next great employment revolution. Your children won't be able to contribute when we need them the most. How do we best engage them? Because, you know, even Jay said, a lot of it comes down to the parents.
Yeah, they seem to be a huge group of people that could be fighting for us.
The parents end up like finding, that they really care about it. I mean, through their students, hearing their students talk about it. I mean, we did have parents come and testify too. There was a guy, he was actually British, the only British guy there, but he came and he had a son that was literally born just in 2016. And he was talking about, I want a better future for my child. Mm-hmm. I want to know that he will be educated, and that he will be ready for post-secondary education, and that he'll be ready to go on to the real world with these issues. I mean, as a parent, you really want what's best for your child. And when you see that that's not given to them, you kind of know in your heart that you want that to change.
I think this is going to sound kind of like what no teenage student wants them. But I think parents should ask their children more questions and be more involved in their lives. Yeah. In terms of that, like sometimes parents get caught up in like their own problems, right? They have to work and they have to like pay the bills and they have to support a family, right? And it's hard to like know what's going on in every single day of your students' lives and like what they care about and what's not being taught, even though you just don't know. The parent doesn't know. So I think the parent doing their own research and asking their children like what's wrong or like what do you think should be there, or you know, doing what's going on and like being involved politically in like the Senate and House is a big thing too.
Yeah.
And so you guys have obviously contacted your representatives in your cities and your school boards. Is there and then some.
Yeah.
How can some of our listeners who maybe don't know how to do that?
Even in a proactive way, even if it's not a problem in their state.
Yeah, right. Just to start it. How should they approach their representatives, their city council, whether they have kids or not, you know, and frame their argument so that the city benefits, you know, not just do it for the children, do it for everyone.
The Teacher Friendly Guide to Climate Change is not only teacher friendly, it's friendly for lots of other readers. And we've actually put together a flyer on how it's a legislator friendly guide as well. And part of that is that it's, you know, easy. We think we've put pretty clear descriptions of the basic physical science, but we've also paid a lot of attention to the social science that makes teaching about climate change a different kind of challenge than teaching about photosynthesis, for example.
Sure.
And I think those social science issues are really important for talking with your legislator or with reporters or with Uncle Fred at the Thanksgiving table.
So, oh boy, we talk about crazy Uncle Bob all the time on the show. Everybody's got one or seven. So, and a quick clarification, can anybody buy the book, Don?
Yes, anybody can buy the book. It's $25 to buy the book, and the PDF is also free for anyone.
And it was
written with funding from the National Science Foundation, which is what allows us to make it free.
Awesome. Nice. That's amazing. And now I imagine it integrates with the new standards.
Yes.
Right? So one could, you know, whether they're, again, have kids or not, but let's say it's someone like me and I've got three young kids. I have so many kids. and they're thinking about the future and they're thinking about what their children are going to get taught in public schools, because yay, public school. And they can go online, they can buy the book for $25. They can learn about what the new standards are and how to effectively teach them and communicate them. And then take that to a city council meeting or, you know, best case scenario we always preach is go run for city council yourself. Be the change you want to see in the world. But take it to a meeting and say, look, here's the deal. I see that we haven't adopted these yet or even attempted to adapt them. Not necessarily fighting them, but I would just like us to get proactive. I've got young kids and I want us to start thinking about how to best integrate this so that we can build citizens that are ready to make change in the world.
I will let you know that city council meetings can be a little long depending on when you go.
Oh, I've done a few, yeah.
Yeah. I attended one for to testify and talk about the building codes and energy codes, and I got there at 5 and I ended up doing my testimony around 11 p.m. So,
oh, that's past curfew.
Yeah, on a school night. It was a long night.
Hopefully you had your discman.
But that also like opened up Therese opportunities to like write an op-ed and also like get more known by like the city council.
Yeah,
yeah. There's also very major pros to sometimes what seems like drooling cons.
Getting a smile from the mayor beater and getting the support from, our pro temp, Lauren McLean, and just having that connection with them is also really powerful. And just seeing the different issues, within our own city. So definitely attend a city council meeting if you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And school board meetings too.
Right. Yeah. Which public schools, again, they're open. And it might not be on the calendar, but again, what we're trying to do here is, but look, climate change is what it is at this point. It's going to get worse. It is already happening. It's been happening. There is a whole conversation we can have about adaptation that needs to happen. We can still be quote unquote proactive in folks going and saying, hey, look, we're at our town is at 40 feet sea level. So, we're in deep shit. We've talked, with other guests about going to your city council, going to your mayor, going to your not necessarily school board and saying, hey, how do our water quality tests look? What are our air measurements look like? And if they don't have an answer, demand one. And if they don't come up with it, then again,
run for office and find it
yourself. But we're trying to encourage proactive change here and proactive actions. And I feel like you guys have, again, that was a drastic all hands on deck, save the day. We want to avoid those. There's going to be more of them. But how do we get proactive so we don't have to deal with those?
Well, one thing that I've done is go and visit my representatives in D.C. or visited them at their local offices or when they have local events. But I went and visited as part of congressional visit days for the American Geophysical Union was the lead organization sponsoring that. If you're in a professional organization, chances are very good that you're, and it's a big professional organization, chances are that they do something like that with visiting Congress folks and help you figure out how to do that. And it's a really interesting learning experience. And it gives you a chance to meet these folks and be a resource for them. We didn't actually meet with the congressmen and senators themselves, but rather with their staffs. But their staffs do an awful lot of the work. And of course, in the current political climate, this is laying groundwork for a future political climate. But there are actually, and Bob Inglis talked about this when he was on the show, was that 2 weeks ago? That I'm drawing a blank on the name of, that requires members of Congress to join in pairs, Jack and Jill caucus, they call it, a Democrat and a Republican have to join together. And there is, I think it's a climate consensus caucus, like that.
Yeah.
And so that's there. It exists and it's grown. I don't remember how many members there are right now, but there are dozens. And they've added members in the last month or two. So it's a growing caucus. There are, as Bob Inglis said on the show, there are a lot of members of Congress who personally believe in that climate change is a real and serious problem caused by us, even though they don't say it aloud. And more of those will be joining up.
All right, guys. So we're getting pretty close to time here. And thank you.
This is great.
So very much. This has been incredible. We're not quite done yet, but we'd like to know, we'd love to hear from you guys. Who else do you think we should have on?
Who should we talk to? And again, what we're focused on is not necessarily just climate change. It's artificial intelligence, anything that's going to affect the species.
Asteroids. We love asteroids.
Is already doing. Yes, asteroids, Brian. I know.
Can you get Elon Musk on
in the next 20 years?
Working on it, Jay.
Okay, Jay. The guy just shot a car into space. Give me a minute, okay? You know, again, what's going to already affecting us or going to affect us in the next 20 years? Like, who are these people that are out there, heroes that we should talk to that can answer a specific question or topic that our listeners can take action on? You know, who inspires you?
Well, a really interesting, I've got a number of ideas. Karen Kirk is a journalist, a science journalist who writes for, among other places, Yale Climate Connections. And she has been engaged in a really interesting project that I've helped out with a little, where she finds pairs of people that don't agree about climate change and has a video conversation with them.
Wow, that's cool.
And gets them talking about climate change. And she's had some success in people sitting in these conversations and changing their minds.
Huh.
And it's really, really interesting. And it's Karen, K-A-R-I-N,
okay.
Kirk, as in James T.
Sure. Yep, got
and
it.
And I can get you the info for her. And Tony Lazarowitz, also at Yale, of the Six Americas. And if you're not familiar with that, Google it, talking about different perceptions of climate change and how different groups of Americans are sort of lumped by alarmed and concerned and some other labels along those lines. And I think you've mentioned Catherine Hayhoe before, and I mean, Catherine's awesome.
Yes, we do love her.
Yep. Awesome. Therese, Jay, anybody you want to hear?
I mean, this is tough for me because I'm also involved in, I mean, human rights and humanitarian. And so I would propose myself to speak about the global humanitarian refugee crisis, but I don't want to
put
myself there twice.
Let's bring it back. No, we're going to dig into that. I mean, you know, I was just reading some today. It'll be in the newsletter tomorrow, you know, saying Africa is well on its way to having 224 million undernourished citizens
who will
eventually be migrants. Because of climate change.
That's one of the real, I mean, that's one of the biggest reasons why. I mean, I'm also involved in this. I mean, there's already a crisis there, and to have, I mean, industrialized countries putting another crisis on people who are already so disadvantaged, it just breaks my heart, in all honesty. Yeah,
for sure.
I'd say, actually, my dad also does the podcast with me that we both do. But my dad is, first of all, a CEO of his own company. And he immigrated here from India. And he has a very, very amazing, actually, life story. His dad died when he was 3. And a lot of what he did is he's very big on education because that's how he got out of poverty. Mm-hmm. And he started his own company. Now the company is all like valued at like $10 million plus dollars. And he has 300 employees. And he can speak on a lot of stuff on the software tech side sector,
but also
leadership but also on terms of like what poverty looks like, you know, and like also the situation in India because he spent so much time there and everything like that.
Yeah, I actually interviewed him for my own research project as well, and he's a really good person, I mean, to just speak with, whether it's something on, I mean, the technology sector or just a personal background and values, for sure.
That's awesome.
Sounds like maybe he could help in getting us Elon Musk. What do you say, Jay?
Yeah.
Get back to us.
All right.
If I ever meet Elon Musk, I'll be like, you should get on this podcast.
Yeah. Thanks, bro.
You're going to lock it up, Jay. All right. Okay, so let's summarize what our listeners and progressives and people with kids and people trying to make kids and people who don't have kids.
People, all the people.
People who just care can do to take action to preserve a full science education for American students. And one is be proactive. And that means downloading or buying materials like Don's book, reading these national standards that aren't federally mandated. And because they're not mandated, that means we need to be proactive. We need to go to city councils and state legislatures and school councils and further drive up to DC or down to DC or east, I guess, and start that conversation ahead of time. And if it comes down to it, you know, getting students involved more, be the change you want to see. And getting those materials to the teachers so that they can take up the fight themselves.
Yeah, how about that? That whole idea of, you can teach it if you want to, but you don't have to and you don't have the materials, this blows my mind.
What am I supposed to do about that?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Oh, yeah, right? I'm making $32,000 a year. I live in the Bronx. So does that sound about right, guys? Again, we're trying to make this as concise and as actionable for people as possible. So correct me if I'm wrong or add anything.
I mean, I would also say if you're really passionate about something, find areas and find people who are already connected with it. Even if it's a student, I mean, there's lots of students who are really passionate about different issues. And if you're able to connect with them and then get more involved and then find where, find your calling, where you fit in, then that's a way for you to be proactive. I had I'm president of our humanitarian club here at Boise High. And I had one of our members, one of my friends, tell me that I've been inspirational to her. And I honestly nice. I didn't realize that. I mean, that the love that I had for what I was doing kind of had a ripple effect. And they were able to find what they loved doing in the club and then also move on to be working with Planned Parenthood. And so there's a ripple effect. I mean, when you really are passionate about something.
That's got to be an incredible feeling.
That's awesome. All right. So, Don, I know you guys all fought on this thing together, but,
What advice could you give for these guys?
Well, keep your chin up, which sounds a little cheesy, but, remember that, we've always thought that the world was about to end, and we've always been wrong about that so far.
Hopefully that trend continues. And
part of the reason that we've been wrong about that in the past is because we did things to change the world. So, when we looked at rivers on fire in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, we created the Environmental Protection Agency, and now the rivers and lakes and such in this country are so much cleaner, and the bald eagle was almost extinct and it isn't anymore. And that's because we figured out things that we needed to do to make the world a better place. And we did them. Right now we're deeply ingrained in denying a lot of the reality around us. And if we can embrace reality, I think we can change reality to make the reality better.
I love that.
Did you hear that, guys?
The world didn't end because we fucking changed the world. That's
that's right. Exactly. That's right.
So no pressure.
No pressure at all.
All right, guys. So listen, we have a few last questions, sort of a lightning round, cool. And then we'll let you guys go. Obviously, you have homework to do.
I wish I didn't.
I love that I
don't. I love that I don't. It's amazing.
I can give you some work for my 6 AP classes if you'd like.
Nope.
Okay. Okay.
Great.
I can find five.
Yeah.
You do that and I'll send you my toddlers to feed for dinner.
Oh, actually, I would love to.
All right. All right, guys. So answer in whatever order you got here. You know, not a life story here, but just a couple sentences. We like this one. When was the first time in your life you realized you had the power of change or the power to do something meaningful?
I think I've always seen myself as a leader growing up. At my elementary school, I was a kind of like an outsider. My sister and I were the only African-American students there. And wow. So to find my place, I kind of had to be a leader and like create my own place where I felt accepted. And so kind of hit me when I was 8 years old and I was paying attention to what was going on in the political world. And it was 2008 and Barack Obama was in the running to be the president. And I really saw that I can be a leader. Nice. And I really miss him. Ugh. But seeing that a person who looked like me could also represent, this nation and be the president, I think that gave me the push to really believe that I could also be a leader. And I think that's when it really started for me, for sure.
That's awesome.
I think, being born, being born here, but then moving to
Jay,
India
you can't
for four
start
years.
With when you were born. That's cheating.
No. It was more of like a transition of like, living in India, I kind of had a different mindset and like I developed like, just like living in India is much, much different than living here. Mm-hmm. And so coming back here was hard. And like I had to adjust like the way I acted and like the way I talked and stuff like that. But, you know, the day like someone told me like, Jay, I look up to you. One of my friends, I think that day I realized, you know, I have do some power and people, if the things I do, people do realize that and recognize that even if it's small.
And you have something to live up to.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so I think, you know, I live up to so many people. If people are living up to me, I have a big, big shoes to fill.
That's awesome. Don.
I'm guessing my answer will be a bit of a surprise to you. When I was an undergraduate, a bunch of my friends and I started a fraternity.
Whoa. Which,
that takes some initiative.
Some initiative, yeah. And
can I ask what school?
The State University of New York at Geneseo. Nice. And the fraternity just yesterday celebrated its 34th anniversary.
Wow.
So
is there a photo of you framed on the wall?
We were able to start something
probably
that has really stuck around. And, you know, we felt like we were doing something when we did it. And it's really made an impact, I think, generally a pretty positive impact on a lot of folks over the years. And I don't think I would have guessed that when I was starting school.
Sure.
but it's a really interesting piece of my life story.
Sure. But if anything else, it taught you, I can make things. I can manifest something.
Yeah, and it's very distinctly not just being in an organization, but either starting it or restarting it, I think, is something that everybody ought to take a stab at anyway.
Sure, sure. All right, guys.
Question number two.
How do you consume the news?
I'll start. A lot of social media.
When I was born.
What? A lot of social media. A lot of me going to like websites I find interesting, mm-hmm. and just reading some of the headlines and stuff. A lot of it is forceful research that I have to do for classes.
not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing. You do learn sometimes, but the view is very few. It's very few.
Got it.
Yeah, but that's how
cool.
I
Therese? Consume
the news.
I mean, for me, I've always loved, I mean, kind of like the news aspect, and I actually really love podcasts. So podcasts for sure for me. Ooh. And Up First, NPR, number one right there.
Yeah, nice.
I I don't really watch the news on like CNN or Fox. Yeah, that's just not for me. But kind of like The Daily Show, just seeing it, that's more of like a liberal kind of side, but also that side. And then reading like The Economist and just a lot of like news articles out there, and like more print than, video for me.
Yeah.
Nice. Tom.
A lot of NPR for me. I listen every morning and every afternoon, pretty much. And a lot of social media. I still am a subscriber to the actual physical paper, the Buffalo News, in my hometown here.
Love it.
A digital subscriber to the Washington Post, which I check on pretty regularly. Chris Mooney would be another good example of a
person. Wait, they still make newspapers?
I didn't write an op-ed.
All right. Yeah.
And a lot from social media. A lot of my professional learning comes from being connected to colleagues on social media that connect me to relevant news and news in my field.
Awesome. Well, we have one last one, and we're going to actually change it up for the first time with you guys. Used to be, what are you reading?
You are very special.
What are you reading these days? But we're going to make it a little more specific starting this week and going forward. And that is, if you could Amazon Prime one book to Donald Trump, what would it be? And I'm even going to addend this further. Don, it can't be your book.
You should send him a copy of your book, absolutely. But another book.
So go ahead, one book, send it 2-day free shipping to 1600 Pennsylvania. What would it be?
I mean, that's definitely tough. I consider myself a book nerd. I actually remember how many books I read in first grade. It was 172. And so just picking one book is kind of tough, but.
Well, it doesn't have to be instructive. It doesn't have to be climate change. It doesn't be the world. It's just, whatever your answer is, your answer.
And he's a big reader.
I have to go with So You Want to Talk About Race. The book was written by a woman who lives in Seattle, and she's it just came out actually like January 15th. So it's a fresh book. It's very, very new. But it really talks about the struggles that, I mean, as a Black woman, being a minority and also a woman, I mean, those two, that really plays. And then it really emphasizes, I mean, looking at that person's standpoint and having empathy for them, and remembering sometimes when you say something to a certain person, I mean, you don't see anything wrong with it, but there's a lot of layers that come behind it, from racism and from, I mean, police brutality and institutionalism and just all the different layers behind what goes on. I mean, a woman of color, and I mean a person like myself. So for sure.
Awesome. I would pick a book called A People's History to the United States of America. Mm-hmm. It's because
Zinn?
Howard
yep,
Zinn.
Yeah. Zinn. Good old Howard Zinn.
That book is way too thick for Trump to read.
The reason is because I think Trump needs to know a little more of his history and also like how he impacts the people. So, you know, I think Zinn, you know, does a really good job expressing all the a really good, very cool perspective on the people.
Everyone should read that book
during the United States. So I'd send that to Trump.
Love it.
Good call.
All right, Don.
Well, I guess we're assuming we're not only sending it to him, but somehow
he's actually going to read it.
Wait, he reads?
Which I think is dreaming.
It's a fantastical world we're in. Look,
just
dreaming up here.
Just go with it, Don. It's a new question. Okay.
Well, I think Jay and Teresa's suggestions are excellent. One possibility, one interesting book that I've read in the last year is by Richard Clark and R.P. Eddy called Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes, which is looking at people, at catastrophes that have happened in the past and finding people who identified them before they happened. And looking for characteristics of folks who are who made calls ahead of the events, which is it's quite interesting.
That's really interesting. That feels like it ties in a little bit to the Black Swan stuff. Interesting. Well, listen, guys, this has been tremendous.
We really great.
Really appreciate it. Where awesome. Can our listeners find you guys online?
I mean, you can find me on almost any form of social media, Instagram, Therese.Itoka, Twitter, at Therese Out. Don't question the username. and also on, articles out there for sure.
Awesome.
You can find me everywhere with the username Technolo-J.
He's a technology nerd.
So like,
nice. I couldn't have guessed.
Technolo, but without the G-Y, the J-A-I, so Technolo-J.
I'm not saying one day you're going to regret that handle. I'm just saying I had one based on Superman growing up on Instant Messenger, and I don't know.
You guys don't know what Instant Messenger is, but that's fine.
I mean, if you want to follow my like personal life, like on Snapchat or something, that's J-A-I-K-B, and then other than that, like literally, like if you want to get a hold of me, if you look up my name, you probably can.
Yeah,
we will find you. And Don,
I'm at Dugan Haas on Twitter, without the hyphen. There is a hyphen between Dugan and Haas.
Don, my last name is hyphenated. We're brothers.
No, that's
what's that?
Not how it works.
Is,
Brian.
Is that how it works?
No.
There's not a lot of guys with hyphenated last names, okay? It's very special. We're part of a small family.
I know, but that doesn't make you relate. All right, listen. This has been great, guys. This has been so much fun.
I love it,
Ryan. Yeah, thank you so much for this opportunity.
We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
There is one more question. We can't leave without asking the last guest, who we haven't asked yet, what member of the Justice League they would be. Don?
Yeah.
Wonder Woman.
Nice. Yeah. That's a good one. Gosh,
you guys
great.
Are great.
You know,
did you see the recent movie with Gail Gadot?
So great.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
She's so much. And just everybody's better than Green Lantern, but Wonder Woman is amazing.
Yeah. Very, very good choice.
Awesome. Well, guys, listen, thank you again. Therese, you. Jay, Don, thank you for coming on. Thank you for all that you do. Don, for everything you've done. Students, for everything you're going to do. We need you real bad. We
thank
do.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
So much.
Keep kicking. Yeah, keep kicking ass out there. And we're depending on you.
Awesome.
Right.
Thank no
you,
pressure.
Guys. Thank you
we'll
so
talk
much.
To you soon. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Ciao.
Thanks to our incredible guests today. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. We hope this episode has made your commute or workout or dishwashing or fucking dog walking late at night that much more pleasant. As a reminder, subscribe to our free email newsletter at importantnotimportant.com, and it is all the news most vital to our survival as a species.
And you can find us all over the World Wide Web. You can follow us on Twitter at importantnotimp, Facebook and Instagram at importantnotimportant, Pinterest and Tumblr, the same thing. So follow us, share us, like us, tell your friends, you know the drill. And please subscribe to our show wherever you listen to things like this. And if you're really fucking awesome, rate us on Apple Podcasts. Help keep the lights on. You can find the show notes from today right in your little podcast player and at our website, importantnotimportant.com.
Thanks, as always, to Tim Bland for all of our jamming music, to all of you for listening, and to our moms for making us. Have a great day.
Thanks, Mom.